Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of July 15th, 2011. This coming week, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau becomes a reality. The agency's goal? To help protect you from getting ripped off, bamboozled, and flim-flammed.
She just didn't fully disclose all of the potential damages that could happen. You know, I really didn't fully understand what I was getting into.
We'll have an example of why the agency was deemed necessary. And just how much attention are you supposed to pay to the stock market?
When CNBC is on at your dentist office, you know there's an issue.
We'll hear how to insulate yourself from all the financial noise. And woe is the recent graduate who doesn't know how to make polite conversation.
These young people who are coming out of college, they're great with math, or they can code like nobody's business, but you bring them to a business lunch and they have no clue what to do.
Oh dear, well, try not to spit up your food for one thing. It's all coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media.
Show Marketplace Money how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/marketplacemoney.
Amid the din over the debt ceiling, you might miss another big story out of Washington this coming week. The Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is officially in business as of next Thursday. This is a new agency that was created a year ago as part of the Dodd-Frank Financial Reform Bill. Like the Consumer Product Safety Commission, which protects you from exploding toasters, the CFPB is supposed to protect you from things like exploding mortgages. But it will start its work next week amid threats by Republicans to defund it, and President Obama has yet to name a director for the agency. This week, the woman charged with getting the agency up and running, Elizabeth Warren, testified before the House Oversight and Government Reform Committee. One lawmaker grilled her on how the agency plans to spend taxpayer money. Like many previous appearances, it was a testy one.
You obviously have a top-line number, and that was based on something, but you seem to be hiding the details of how you came up with those numbers.
Congressman, no one's hiding anything. We publish all contracts in, it's not called the Federal Register, there's a special place these are published, but
I'm not talking about the contracts. You have only on your website for consumer. I'm worried about the person who's out, you know, in Albuquerque or in Provo, Utah. How do they find out the makeup of all these numbers and the details? As the Appropriations Committee suggested, they can't see that information. I doubt the public can see it either.
Then they may want to go to www.usaspending.gov.
That was Warren trying to respond to questions from Republican Congressman Jason Chaffetz of Utah. It is far from the first time the former Harvard professor has been beat about the head while on the Hill. And later in the proceedings, Democrat Jim Cooper of Tennessee urged more comity from members of the committee.
I didn't vote for Dodd-Frank. It had many good features. It had some less good features. But I do not want to be part of a committee treated Ms. Warren with more rudeness and disrespect than I have ever seen a committee witness treated. That is not the American way.
It may not be the American way, but it certainly has been the way, the path of this embattled agency. Less than a year into its existence, there's been talk of changing it from an agency with one boss to an agency, like the Securities and Exchange Commission, with multiple overseers from both parties. As we've mentioned, there are also threats to withhold funding. So, how about a reminder of why Congress and the White House created the CFPB in the first place? Here's Marketplace's Jeff Horwich.
When lawmakers crafted Dodd-Frank and the CFPB, they were thinking about folks like Joe McIntosh. Sure, the Bureau is supposed to police shady credit card deals, payday lending, student loans, but Joe's house in Golden Valley, Minnesota, that was the heart of the financial crisis.
It was a spouse of a friend, actually, who did the mortgage. You know, you try to go with somebody you trust, and she burned me.
Joe bought the house in 2006. Wasn't clear at the time, but his buddy's wife put him in a negative amortization loan. Joe's monthly payments were fixed lower than the accruing interest. He was actually increasing his principal each time he sent in a check.
She just didn't fully disclose all of the potential damages that could happen. You know, I really didn't fully understand what, I was getting into.
Joe was adding $600 every month to what he owed on the house. So he found another broker he trusted who offered to refinance him into something safe.
The extent that I, again, was aware of, I was signing a 30-year fixed loan with a certain interest rate. I think it was like 6.5% or something like that. Boom, I'm good to go.
Yeah, not so much. Turns out Joe could have qualified for a lower interest rate, but no one told him that.
When the mortgage broker charged me a higher interest rate, he gets a bigger percentage of my loan or a certain kickback on my loan. That was one of the line items that I signed during the closing documents. I had no clue. It was in small print on one of them.
What Joe calls a kickback is called a yield spread premium in the trade, and it was legal at the time in most of the country, though it had just been outlawed in Minnesota. This is why Joe's got a lawyer, Jane Bowman.
The mortgage broker actually got 2% of the amount of Joe's loan to get Joe to sign on to a higher interest rate. And I calculated the increased payments that Joe would be making over the life of the loan. The outer range was about $100,000.
Joe got a settlement, but he stuck with the loan and a house he admits he can borderline afford.
Who knows if I would have elected to purchase the home I'm in if I knew I would have had to pay an additional $1,000 every single month. You know, probably not.
As much as Joe feels bamboozled by inscrutable paperwork and brokers out to make an easy buck, he's skeptical about a new Consumer Financial Protection Bureau that's supposed to prevent this kind of thing.
Unless this bureau is going to send somebody out, you know, and sit down with me at my closing to explain, you know, each line item on 30 pages, you know, I just have a very shallow understanding of all of that. You know, is it possible to make it transparent? For someone like myself, I would argue no.
His lawyer, Jane Bowman, says the political fog makes it hard to know just what the Bureau will and won't be able to do when it opens for business on Thursday. In St. Paul, I'm Jeff Horwich for Marketplace Money.
What does Tier 1 Capital have in common with a wedding cake? Visit the Marketplace whiteboard to find out. Our videos demystify finance and economics. Just go to our website, marketplace.org.
All right, so what do we know about what the Bureau will and won't be able to do when it hangs out the open for business sign in a few days? Mike Calhoun heads up the Center for Responsible Lending, and from that title, you will no doubt gather that he is fully in favor of this agency. So with that said, he's here to tell us exactly what to expect. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Let's start with, say, the top things that the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is mandated to do.
The Consumer Bureau will be addressing pretty much all the aspects of the mortgage. This will cover everything from how the loans are sold, how the people who sell the loans are incented and paid for those loans, to the disclosures borrowers get, and to the substantive terms of the loans themselves. It will be both efforts to improve disclosures, but also to put in place baseline substantive protections to help people get more sustainable mortgages.
And what about beyond mortgages?
The Consumer Bureau also has important responsibilities to look at everything from credit cards, car loans, consumer finance loans, all the ways that financial products hit individual households throughout their lives.
Then let's talk about how far they are into this actually becoming a reality. It's been a year since Dodd-Frank was passed. How much of the Bureau is set up and ready to do all these things that you've just talked about?
Well, setting up a new agency and transferring people from other agencies is a significant undertaking. They've made a lot of progress, and the doors will open on July 21st. They will begin mostly with supervision of financial services providers, banks in particular, to look at what their practices are and make sure they're following the law, and also looking to see where there are problems, where are consumers and families getting products that aren't clear or really have hidden tricks and traps.
Mm-hmm.
As has been discussed by many, there are challenges in that the Bureau does not have a director at this point.
Right.
Elizabeth Warren has been acting as a special advisor to the president, but not in a specific nominated or confirmed position to this point.
I want to get back to the folks that we heard in Jeff's piece a moment ago who basically have a couple of concerns. The borrower is skeptical and the lawyer is not confident that anything's going to change because still nothing is written in stone. Are those concerns justified?
The concerns are justified, but those protections, some of them are already in place and others are rapidly being put into place. Now, there is some pushback trying to slow down the Bureau and keep it from moving forward. But I expect that in particular in the mortgage area, I think because of the central role that mortgages played in the financial crisis, there is more agreement that reforms are needed in the mortgage industry. And we're well down the road in getting those in place. And they'll make a big difference, not just for home buyers, but for all property owners. If you have a foreclosure down the street, that hurts you whether you've got a mortgage or not. It pushes down your property value. And as we found out, tanking the housing industry has been devastating for the whole economy. And if we're going to turn around the overall economy, I think there has to be improvement in the housing market.
You are the president of the Center for Responsible Lending, but I wonder about a Center for Responsible Borrowers. I mean, as much as lending got out of hand, so did borrowing. Any thoughts on how to address that part of the equation?
Yes, borrowers, even with additional protection, still bear responsibility to watch out for their interest. And one of the major goals of the Consumer Bureau, and one of the things they have initially focused on, is how to turn the maze of fine print and legalese into some plain, short, simple English where people understand better what they're getting in a financial product. So, for example, the home buyer thought they were getting a 30-year fixed-rate loan, and it's hard to sort out that you're not getting that when you get a couple inches of paper at the closing table. So one of the first things that the Bureau has done is come up with a simple, short disclosure that gives people those basic pieces of information. This is the kind of loan you're getting. Your mortgage payment can go up this much. Your loan does not have you paying the full amount. So that by looking at this short form, you get a warning. You're not going to understand all the fine print. You need a PhD and a MBA and probably a law degree to do that. But you can get the critical warnings about, is this loan a sustainable loan and one that's suited for you? And if not, at least it will trigger the homeowner to ask questions, and the homeowner needs to ask questions at that point.
Mike Calhoun is president of the Center for Responsible Lending in Washington. Thank you so much.
Thank you for having me on today.
Coming up, piggyback loans helped lots of people get mortgages a few years ago, and now they're coming back to haunt. Homeowners are desperate for help.
My guess is it's not widely known at all, since until you told me about it, I didn't know about it.
How a little-known legal provision could provide assistance. That's later on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland, and it's time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is our economics editor, Chris Farrell. Hey, Chris.
Hey, Tess. It's good to be with you again.
Always glad to have you on the show. I wanted to ask you about an article that I saw on smartmoney.com this week about tuition hikes and how all the state budget woes are meaning that some students could find that they don't have the financial aid packages that they were expecting, that
Right.
they don't have the grants that they were expecting. What are you supposed to do when you're, what, a month out from going off to college?
Well, there are really two reactions. Middle-class families, they're going to dip deeper into their savings. They're going to borrow a little bit more. Where the real hit is coming, Tess, is students from low-income families.
Mm.
These tuition increases really hit them hard. And of course, losing the grant money, that really hurts. And often these are, you know, the first generation to go on to college. So it's really troublesome with low-income families because they're not going to college enough as it is. And this is just another push against them getting a degree.
Yeah, I mean, you look at some of the tuition hikes, and for example, here in California, they're looking at increasing tuition by up to 12%.
Yes.
Earlier this year, they already raised it by 10.
I was going to say, it's not like tuition has been stable for the past 5,
right.
6, 7, 8 years. And
right.
then we say, okay, well, they're going to raise by 12%. All right. No, it's been going up considerably. So for everybody who's facing this, the answer isn't don't go to college. It's take a look at your community college. See what's going on there. Can you get some courses there? You know, if you go to community college for 2 years, you can transfer to a public four-year university if you want that four-year degree.
Right.
And you get the degree from that particular four-year institution, but the cost is about half.
All right. Well, on that positive note.
Okay. So now.
Shall we hear from our dear listeners?
Please.
All right. Well, let's go to Don, and he is in Salt Lake City, Utah. Hi, Don.
Hi.
So what do you do there in Salt Lake?
I do media relations for a large nonprofit organization.
So you try to get your organization onto shows like this one.
Yeah, yeah, you can say that.
Well, what do you do there for fun?
Well, for fun, what I like to do is I like to go through garage sales and thrift stores and consignment stores looking for good deals.
That is something that, Chris, I always wish that I had the patience for, but I can't stand going through piles and piles and piles of junk just to find that one thing that's going to be a real value.
No, I don't have that gene either. But I know lots of people who this is their pastime. This is what
right.
they like doing. And, of course, then the internet is open to what? The whole world that you can be scouring around and finding stuff.
Right. So, Don, what's your secret? Well, if I'm going to, say, the flea market over at the Rose Bowl in a couple of weeks, what's my strategy?
First, you want to find out what people are avoiding. And then the next thing is just look for what you're really interested in. A lot of people go and they don't really know what they're looking for. And I mean, sometimes you can find a surprise, but most of the time you're going with something specific in mind. Because there's so many options at a flea market or a swap meet that
yeah.
you're likely to run into exactly what you're looking for a pretty good price.
All right. Well, next time I go, I'm going to take you with me.
Oh, okay.
you could have a business on like how to, you know, run to your local flea market and actually find a bargain.
Well, as a matter of fact, that's part of the reason why I'm calling.
Oh.
It's an idea to have all of the types of resale opportunities in a community online. People who are looking for, say, I don't know, a baby stroller. If they go to this website and they type in baby stroller, then all of the baby strollers across all of those venues come up.
So you're like a resale online mall.
Something like that.
Interesting.
I like that idea. That's really intriguing.
So you got a business plan set up for this?
Yep, it's all written.
Well, what do you need us for then?
Well, I'm calling because I know that your advice is to never take any money out of your 401k.
Yes, let's stop right there.
Yes. But in the past, when you tell people not to take money out of their 401k, you tell them not to take money out for home improvements or not to take money out for vacations or not to take money out for, you know, a whole bunch of other things. But I can't think of a better reason to borrow from yourself because there are opportunities to borrow. But it seems to me that banks, they want to loan me money on long-term debt. What I need is a short-term loan, but they only give it to me at a high interest rate.
Okay, so you're looking at taking a short-term loan from your 401k, so you are currently still employed?
Yes.
Two reactions from me.
Okay.
A loan is different from just taking money out and not repaying it.
Yes.
But any money that you take out is money that you're going to lose on the backside in retirement.
Yeah, so let's put a couple things right out on the table. This is a great idea.
You mean the business idea is great?
The business idea. I'm not talking about the necessarily borrowing from your 401k.
Yes. Yeah.
The real risk that you're taking there, as Tess mentioned, you have less compounding over time. The other risk is if you did lose your job.
Yes.
You have 6 months to put the money back in, or it's treated as early withdrawal, which means then you pay ordinary income taxes on the amount you withdrew plus a 10% penalty. It's going to all of a sudden turn into a very expensive source of capital as opposed to a relatively inexpensive source of capital.
But isn't there a more positive way to look at it, that if the business becomes successful, then I start to earn money that I can then put back into the 401k faster? I mean, I know that's the risk, but isn't that an upside risk as well as a downside risk?
It's all about trade-offs. What you're thinking about is not crazy, but let me just toss out a couple of other ideas there. Why not just go to the bank and see if you can get a bank loan?
You mean like a signature loan?
Just a signature loan. And the other thing to limit your risk is to bring in a partner who might put up a little bit of money. They share in the downside risk, but they also share, and this is where entrepreneurs always get in the, you know, always wonder about, but they also share on the upside.
I just want to tell you guys, I really love the show, and I listen. I'm a religious listener.
Thank you.
And I kind of knew you were going to say this.
Well, yeah, but, you know, you didn't get a flat no. I think, honestly, if you had been talking about just taking the money out, that's when we would have a little more issue with it, because it just, you get hit with all these taxes and penalties and all that sort of thing.
Yeah.
A loan is a little different story. And, you know, if you really believe in this business, then, and you know what the risk is, it is your money.
And it is your life.
All right. Well, Let us know what you end up doing.
Thanks very much.
All right. Thanks so much for the call, Don.
Bye.
All right. Mary Margaret is now with us from Jacksonville, Florida. Hi, Mary Margaret.
Hi. How are you?
Very well. Thank you. How are you doing there in Florida?
We're doing well. Hot and muggy, but well.
I've actually been to Jacksonville. It's a beautiful city.
Isn't it? It's very nice.
Yeah. So I went to, there was some old military fort there.
There are a number. If you went to St. Augustine, there's the fort in St. Augustine, which is the oldest city in America.
Yeah.
So
beautiful history there.
Yeah.
And I used to work on a tanker. And that was one of the ports of call was Jacksonville.
Oh, wow. Lots of people get into Jacksonville.
So what do you do there when you're not...
Sweltering in the heat.
Sweltering in the heat, exactly.
I teach law.
Ah, what kind of law?
All sorts of law, but this summer I am teaching a class on the intersection of criminal law and victims. So how does the criminal justice system respond to victims? That's real interesting. It's a seminar class, so we're lots of discussion and debate, and everybody's writing papers. So
you've had a very interesting court case example right there in Florida recently?
Right there in Florida, and we certainly spent a good deal of one of our classes talking about it. Yes, indeed.
Well, so are we still paying off law school student loans then?
We are still paying off law school student loans, but it's manageable. The real loan that I'm sort of calling about is the degree I got before I went to law school that was graciously financed by the Bank of Dad. So the Bank of Dad has no interest, and the Bank of Dad is especially lenient.
Let's not let the IRS hear that then, that there's no interest on this.
Right. Well, there's been daughterly interest.
Yes.
Yeah.
So what kind of money are we talking about here?
Well, the money is, I'm nearly done.
Good.
I've been very diligent the last sort of nearly 2 years of sending my dad $500 every month, and I'm going to be done, and I am used to not having that money, and so I wanted some advice as to how to responsibly use that money.
What, you mean you're not just going to use that extra $500 to go have fun now?
Well, I thought maybe for a month I might I might gallivant a bit.
Take the month, yes, absolutely.
but I just thought if I'm already in the discipline of knowing that there's this little pile of money that doesn't belong to me, that I could put it in some other places. And, I mean, I have a 401k, I have a Roth IRA, and then I'm trying to build up my own little personal savings account. So I was trying to figure out what would be the best way to allocate this little windfall.
Great question.
That is wonderful. This is great. Yes.
So, Chris, an extra $500 a month, where does it go?
Okay. So part of it is practical. Part is emotional. You can't go wrong. If it were me, I'd be putting the money into an emergency savings fund. My guess is with Tess. Tess doesn't like debt. Given the option, Tess might say, well, you know what? I'm going to put it toward those student loans because I'm going to get out of debt quicker.
Depends on what kind of interest rates you got there.
Mm-hmm.
This is true.
Do you know what it is?
Yeah, I do. 3.42%.
Okay, so you've basically got free money there.
Yeah.
In which case, Chris, I agree with you.
You'd
think an emergency fund is just so vital and so important, and not just practically, but to your mental well-being.
It's freedom of choice.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
Great. Well, this has been helpful.
Well, thanks so much for the call. Great question.
Thank you very much.
And finally, we have Christina right here in Pasadena, California. Hi, Christina.
Hi, how are you?
Good. I wonder if maybe you're just down the street from me.
Actually, not right now. We're on vacation. We are.
Ooh, where are you?
We're in Monterey right now. We camped out in Victor last night. We're enjoying the sights. So.
That's one of my favorite drives in the entire country. It's
gorgeous,
so spectacular.
Yeah. My husband was driving, and I was looking at the water the whole time. So
So what do you do when you're not on vacation?
I'm a teacher at a high school down in Los Angeles. I teach 10th grade world history.
10th graders, that must be a good audience there.
They are. They have a lot of energy and a lot of spunk, and they make things interesting for me, and I try to return the favor. So
Is spunk one way to put it?
Yeah, it's a nice way to put it. Yeah. But I do love it. I do have a good time.
How can we help you out today?
My question is about a tax-sheltered annuity I set up when I started teaching.
Huh.
What happened was, you know, as part of my orientation, a financial planner came in to talk to us about supplementing our pension, and he signed me up for one of these tax-sheltered annuities, these TSAs.
Uh-huh.
And over time, I kind of got bits of information that maybe it wasn't the best investment vehicle. So I haven't actually contributed to it in about 3 years. So I just wanted to get some advice on what I should do with it.
Okay.
Sure.
Chris, let's start with a definition for everybody. What is a tax-sheltered annuity?
Okay. So what this is a 403B, which many people who work in the nonprofit sector, state and local teachers are aware of. A 403B. It's like a 401K.
In fact, it's what you and I have.
That's right. Do you have a 403B where you're working now?
No, I'm just actually contributing to my IRA and the pension right now.
Okay. Your 403B is fine. These are legitimate people. But, you know, I always like the idea, if you're no longer working there, maybe you just want to roll it over and put it into an IRA. And then you get to choose the investments and you have control over it.
Will I encounter any issues with the fact that my TSA was pre-tax and the IRA is post-tax, I think?
Well, no. What it is, so what you're going to do, the easiest way to do that, so you have pre-tax contributions into your 403B. You can open up a traditional IRA, which is also with pre-tax money, and you do what's called an institution-to-institution transfer. Actually, the money doesn't really come into your hands. In order to preserve that tax shelter aspect, it will go from one institution into another institution. So actually, your job is mostly going to be on the paperwork side of things, just to make sure that this is done the right way, because you don't want to trigger a tax liability.
Okay.
All right. Does that clear things up?
It does. Do you feel that I'll encounter a lot of fees when I try to transfer?
You shouldn't.
You really shouldn't. There really shouldn't be much in terms of fees.
Okay. Great. Well, thank you so much.
You bet. Enjoy the rest of your vacation.
I will.
All right. Take care, Christina.
Thank you. You too.
We are here to take your money questions. Give us a call at 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY. Or send us an email. You can do that at the Getting Personal link on our website. It's marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much. It's been fun.
It's been fun, Tess. Thanks a lot.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before making any big money decisions. We've addressed your questions, but now let's get to some of your thoughts and comments about the show. Here with me is our bag lady.
Hey.
I mean, our mailbag lady, Deb Clark, our senior producer. Hey, Deb.
Hi, Tess.
All right, mailbag lady and boss, I should probably mention.
Well, yes, but that's only relevant because it relates to a segment we did last week about bad bosses.
Of which I know nothing.
That's good. Let's just keep moving here. This got a lot of reaction from people. We were talking about horrible bosses because of the release of the movie of the same name, not one I have seen.
Nor I.
Yes, well, William Cohn of North Olmsted, Ohio, wrote in about his own experience with a lousy employer. One day at work, he was so sick, he nearly passed out. His boss's thoughtful response?
When you finish your shift, you can go to the hospital. He taught me a lot about how not to be a boss and showed me the best way to deal with a jerk boss, to quit.
Sounds like a great solution.
Yes, indeed. He did also say, by the way, that he'd had some great bosses over the years and had even been willing to get paid less to stay working for them. So other people who wrote in about this segment made note of the fact that our guest, Allison Green, kept referring to bad bosses as she. Tracy Powling from Indianapolis, Indiana, said that was an unfair association.
There are plenty of bad male bosses out there. I recently worked for one who would write me up for his mistakes. What makes it worse, this boss owned the company.
Couldn't agree more. And in fact, you know, I did ask about that during the interview. It ended up on the cutting room floor. But I did point out to Allison that she kept talking about women bosses. And so I asked whether there is a difference in how you should deal with a male or female boss.
I don't know that there's a dramatic gender difference. I always try to be sort of gender neutral when I'm in the workplace and forget that I'm a woman because I don't want people dealing with me as a woman first.
Yep. Amen.
Amen, sister. Okay. Another item from last week that got much reaction. Ramit Sethi offered his thoughts on how to build up savings.
Right. He said it's all fine and good to be frugal, but the only way you're going to truly change your financial situation is to earn more money.
Right. Find something you're good at, teaching music, doing a little IT consulting. Mm-hmm. He says consultants can make $100 an hour. Leonard Daly, who is such a consultant from Sherman Oaks, California, wrote in to splash a little reality on that suggestion.
I wish picking up the extra $1,000 a month for 20 hours work was as easy as he implies. If I charged $100 an hour to my small business clients, I would have very few of them. And most corporations needing IT work want you available during normal business hours, not nights and weekends.
A couple of other folks wrote in to say that just because you're good at something does not mean you make a good teacher.
Well, that is for sure. All right, so what else?
So finally, I guess a note of caution.
Uh-oh.
Yeah, well, so Chris Ferner posted on our Facebook page about a recent caller we talked to with Kathy Kristoff of CBS Money Watch. Mm-hmm. Kathy mentioned fastweb.com, good place to find scholarships, she said. Ferner's wife is getting a degree in accounting, so they signed up for that. Seems that after registering, they were inundated with ads and spam messages.
Oh, yikes. Sorry about that.
Yeah, indeed. Thanks for the heads up, too.
All right. Keep those coming. Go to our Facebook page, or you can tweet me at Radio Tess. And, of course, there's the old-fashioned email. Thanks, Deb.
Thank you, Tess.
It is hard to escape the daily barrage of information about the stock market. At home, work, in the car, you can even get the latest stock quotes on your phone. Ever wonder why?
I think it's become America's greatest spectator sport. It's something to talk about. It's what all of our friends may or may not be talking about.
And we'll talk about it next on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. I'm Tess Vigeland. I'll make an educated guess that we're going to get some reaction to this next story. Anytime we feature a way for someone to get out from under a crushing debt burden, we get letters about how people should be responsible for their debts and should have to pay them. Well, that said, this is about an element of the bankruptcy code that allows borrowers to discharge what's called a second or piggyback mortgage. And it potentially allows those people to stay in their homes instead of losing them. Marketplace's Jennifer Collins reports.
There are signs of financial trouble all over Leif Manson's house, a five-bedroom in a Denver suburb.
Okay.
There's not much furniture and...
broken window from a flying toy. Taped up right now.
The lawn has taken a beating from four kids with a football.
We've kind of neglected our yard, but that's because we were living with uncertainty for the past 4 years in the middle of this process.
That process began when Madsen lost his job in 2007 and then nearly lost his $300,000 home. He eventually filed for bankruptcy. That let him keep the house while he worked out a payment plan for his debts. Under a little-known provision in the bankruptcy code, Madsen may also be able to get out of paying his second mortgage. Ike Schulman is co-founder of the National Association of Consumer Bankruptcy Attorneys.
For people who hear about it for the first time, it's like somebody just told them they can save their home.
I'll explain in a minute how Madsen may be able to wipe away a $30,000 second mortgage. But first, a reminder of how he and lots of other people got into trouble in the first place. During the housing boom, banks were doling out mortgages and credit for the asking. And millions of people bought homes they couldn't afford and then borrowed against them by taking out second mortgages or home equity lines of credit. It was easy because banks believed home values and home equity would keep rising.
Yeah, they were pretty dumb loans. Here we had an industry develop around people not having equity in their house.
That's Richard Green, director of the Lusk Center for Real Estate at the University of Southern California. We all know what happened next. The housing market crashed and people owed more than their houses were worth. Which brings us back to Madsen. He took out a $30,000 second mortgage to make the down payment on his house, meaning he went into debt for nearly the entire price of the home.
When I signed off on the paperwork, I said, are we going to be able to do this? Because I really wasn't sure.
No, he wasn't able to. His adjustable rate first mortgage, which started out at $1,500 a month, doubled. Meanwhile, the value of his house dropped 20%, meaning there was no equity back in the second mortgage. Plus, he ran up $10,000 in credit card debt trying to cover his bills while he was unemployed.
Bankruptcy suddenly becomes the only realistic way to say, I can get out of debt, I can suffer with my credit thing, and then I learn my lesson.
Under the bankruptcy code, homeowners like Madsen can often work out a payment plan with the courts to pay pennies on the dollar for their debts. If a debtor sticks to the plan for 3 to 5 years, the second mortgage will be forgiven. As many as 4 million homeowners may be able to unload second mortgages if they file for bankruptcy. Many of them are completely unaware the option exists. Again, Richard Green.
My guess is it's not widely known at all, since until you told me about it, I didn't know about it.
Green says when a second mortgage is eliminated, banks are more inclined to modify the original loan. That could prevent foreclosures and help thousands of people stay in their homes. Bankruptcy lawyer Ike Schulman says he's helped homeowners eliminate as much as $7.5 million of second mortgage debt in the past 2 years.
The amount of debt relief that's out there and available to people who need it is enormous.
Leif Madsen and his wife are now 2 years into bankruptcy. Madsen has a new job. The bank has just finalized a modification on his original loan. He's paying $1,800 a month instead of $3,000.
I have a lesson that'll carry forever. But when my children come to this point, when they want to buy houses, the wisdom that we get from this will carry us forward.
As for Madsen and his wife, they're not going anywhere. They plan to stay in the house they fought for forever. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace Money.
Now, there are folks out there who can claim a big told you so when it comes to the housing collapse. We've got a post from one of them on our Making Money blog. Every now and then we check in with Carl Richards, founder of Prasada Capital Management in Park City, Utah. You might be familiar with his drawings in the New York Times Bucks blog, where he takes an economic term or idea and, using a Sharpie, illustrates it on a napkin. Well, we've got Carl back with us for another rendering. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Tess. Good to be here.
All right. Tell us what we're looking at on this napkin.
So this is a classic line graph, and on the x-axis is labeled long-term wealth, and the y-axis is labeled following the market, and the line is sloping downward.
And what are we saying here?
Essentially, what we're saying is building long-term wealth has an inverse relationship to following the market.
All right. So I have to ask, do you know how the market's doing today?
I don't.
Okay,
that's a good sign. That's a good sign.
That's so counterintuitive, though. I mean, we are bombarded with the daily fluctuations of the stock market. Why are we so obsessed with that, and how unhealthy is that?
I think it's become America's greatest spectator sport.
Yeah.
I think the access to information, and it is certainly entertaining, right? I mean, it's something to talk about. It's what all of our friends may or may not be talking about. You feel out of the loop if you don't know what's going on in the market. Now, again, 2 years ago, it was because we were just sheer panic and we didn't know what to do.
Right.
But even before then, back in 2000, you know, it really became sort of when CNBC is on at your dentist office, you know there's an issue.
Is there any point to talking about the Dow or the S&P?
Well, I think there's a fine line here. And this graph was generated by a conversation from a close family friend that really didn't understand exactly what I did for a living and would repeatedly ask me, hey, how are things going in the market? And I would say, I really don't know. I haven't really been paying that much attention. And after having that conversation repeatedly, he finally said to me, what do you do? Right? And that was where I came up with this idea that if investment success is about behavior, then information and skill may not have as much to do with it as we think. But to your question, right, it's important for us to be informed when we're making those decisions. But
right,
we shouldn't be making investment decisions daily.
How often should we be making them then?
Well, and again, I think this is part of the big problem here is maybe reframing the discussion.
Hmm.
Maybe the reframing is making sure that the investments we own match our lives, our goals, our view of, this is a big fuzzy word, but our view of risk. But making sure they match our goals would allow us to not be thinking about these every day, every month, every quarter even.
Yeah. How do you counter the noise, though?
I don't know. One trick I've learned is to maybe view it as the, instead of the money section, maybe it's the funny section. Jim Cramer's a great example, right? Some people would say, don't watch Cramer. Well, it's fine. Just recognize that it's entertainment, not money. And if you can talk yourself into it, it's much more fun to go to the movies, So it may just be trying to find a replacement for that constant chatter or realizing that it's an important part of the discussion and it has value and it's valuably informed, but just don't act on it or have some stop gaps in place to make sure you have to jump through a couple hoops before you act on it. Might make sense.
All right. So you're not telling people to stop listening to financial shows, right?
Oh, of course not. And I'm not, absolutely, of course not. Just don't necessarily run out and act on it.
All right. Thanks, Carl.
Thank you, Tess.
And you can find Carl's Sharpie drawings and a link to his blog, Behavior Gap, at marketplace.org/money.
Hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket, hands in my pocket.
Because of your giant wallet, just get rid of it. Never. It is a part of me.
Hi, my name is Andrea Dundas, and I live in North Hollywood, California, and we're in front of the Disney Concert Hall. What's in my wallet?
Okay. Cash. My credit cards. My Blockbuster card. Still have my Blockbuster card. Stamps. My blackjack. How to play blackjack card. You can buy it at the gift stores in Las Vegas. It basically tells you what to hit and what to stay. Because I'm still learning blackjack, so I want to know the rules. So it's like a little cheat card. So the card lists the numbers 2 through 8 on one side, and then it shows you what your pairs would potentially be, what it would add up to. And then based on what you have in your hand, you can decide whether you're going to split, hold, or save. I was last in Vegas in April for my birthday. I did win. I won about $2,000. The card works.
Competition for jobs these days is fierce. But for members of the millennial generation, the market is downright cutthroat. It is not enough to have a college degree or two and maybe even an internship under your belt. No, to get a real job, you need manners? Wait, this needs to be spelled out? Are you kidding me? Apparently not. Here's reporter Alex Goldmark.
Millennials can blog and tweet like pros. Multitasking is second nature. These skills are something boomer bosses appreciate. But younger workers aren't always so good at focusing or communicating face-to-face.
And even the idea of eye contact many times can be challenging. Not so much that it gets creepy, but if we're talking with someone, you expect that they will be able to focus on you for the full 2 minutes, 3 minutes.
Jennifer Loftus is the president of HRNY and the head of consulting firm Astron Solutions. She and her HR colleagues view this generation as a challenge and an opportunity.
These young people who are coming out of college, they're great with math, or they can code like nobody's business, but you bring them to a business lunch and they have no clue what to do.
Knowing when and how to pick up the tab and what to order can help a candidate stand out from the competition. Now keep in mind, around 16% of 18 to 24-year-olds are unemployed, almost twice the national average.
Many times if you have two candidates who are equally skilled, they're equally talented, who's going to get the upper hand when it comes to making that final decision? The person who presents well, the person who suits up well.
So, to get an edge, more and more millennials are turning to the pros. Patricia Napier Fitzpatrick is the director of the Etiquette School of New York. She says business is booming with 20-somethings. Usually, they're signed up by a parent, but increasingly, it's their companies.
Their bosses call me and say, he's great, he's smart, he's tech savvy, except, and then he lists all these things that he needs. I'm like, well, why are you keeping him now? Because he's smart, we like him.
Tonight's two-hour class has two students, both 20-somethings. They've paid $200 to be here. We're seated around an ornate dining table with spiral-bound workbooks in front of us.
So how do you distinguish yourself from the competition? On the next page, you have presence PowerPoints. Your presence PowerPoints. Have you heard that term before?
No, I have not.
No.
Fitzpatrick is instructing us on things like how to make eye contact at the office. Keep it in the triangle between the eyes and the center of the hairline, never below the neck. We also practice shaking hands, formal introductions, and get tips on softer skills like schmoozing.
Okay, so let's talk about now about improving your mingling proficiency. What's your definition of small talk? What's your definition of
My favorite go-to is the weather. Can't fail.
The weather.
Everybody has an opinion on the weather.
That is interesting. I'm writing that down.
You haven't thought about the weather as small
talk? No, the thing is, I just always thought other people just didn't like it as much as me.
It really does take time, practice, and training to build up your best behavior.
What if you're left-handed, though?
You can't shake hands with your left hand.
Even if you're left-handed?
No.
Huh.
Matt Stevens just finished college and is applying to graduate schools. He knows what he has to work on. That's why he's here.
I don't think I've met my potential when it comes to social situations and being able to maintain a professional and a mature appearance.
He's wearing a well-fitted suit and looks just fine to me. Fitzpatrick gave him high marks on attire, too. According to a study by the Society of Human Resource Management, the top workplace complaint about his generation is inappropriate dress. I'm a few years too old to be considered a millennial, but apparently I share that shortcoming.
Jackets are professional.
I have a button-down. That's close.
That's a button-down?
What?
Your shirt is a button-down?
It's a button. Well, it's, yeah.
Well, you look fine.
At least I kept my elbows off the table. In New York, I'm Alex Goldmark for Marketplace Money.
And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award. Our little blue squealing plastic friend is heading to, what do you know, Jacksonville, Florida. You may remember one of our callers today hailed from that hot, steamy, and lovely corner of the globe. Well, I was impressed with something she said, so we called her back to talk about it.
This is Mary Margaret.
Hi, Mary Margaret. It's Tess Vigeland at Marketplace Money again.
Hey, Tess. How are you?
Good, thanks. So I wanted to call you back because I have some news for you.
Okay.
You are the winner of this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award.
Well, thank you. I'm honored.
We either give it to people who have made great financial decisions or who perhaps need some help making a financial decision. But I was very impressed with the fact that you're going to take this money, this $500 a month that you were paying off to your bank of dad.
Uh-huh.
And instead of just incorporating it back into your budget, you're going to keep setting that aside as though you still don't have it anymore. That's a tough thing to do.
Oh, yeah. Well, thank you. I really appreciate that affirmation.
Well, so you will be getting our little blue friend in the mail. That should get you on your way for your emergency fund.
Thank you so much. I'm really delighted. I really appreciate it.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. The conversation continues all week long on my journalist page on Facebook. Tell me what you want to hear on the show, what you don't want to hear. Bring it, people. So go like it, You will like it. And as always, follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, a look at Social Security and how it's viewed by different generations.
Well, I hope there's some there, but I'm not planning on being the backbone of my retirement.
You and me both. Marketplace Money is produced by Deborah Clark with Devin Robbins and Stephen Hoffman. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is J.J. Yore. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.